Well, good evening and welcome to Health Matters. I'm Kermit Poling and I will be your host this evening. Here's a big phrase for you: chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Now, that's a mouthful, but it's what we typically refer to as COPD. And November is COPD Awareness Month. It's the third leading cause of death in the United States. A major contributor to developing COPD is smoking. And in fact, the American Lung Association says that 85 to 90% of COPD cases are related to cigarette smoking. So on this show, we're going to talk about COPD and treatment, smoking cessation, and other lung health issues. And I'm joined on this program by Dr. Bob Walter, who's Chief of Pulmonary and Critical Care at LSU Health Shreveport, and also Courtney Rayburn, who's a tobacco treatment specialist with the Willis-Knighton Health Systems. And of course, you can participate in this show as well. We will be taking your questions and comments at 800-552-8502. So to the two of you, first of all, welcome and thanks for joining me this evening.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Walter, let's start with you. And I think most people are familiar with terms like emphysema and all of that. But what exactly is COPD? And is it the same? And what's different?
So, as you rightly point out, smoking is the biggest risk factor for COPD, particularly in the United States. But people forget worldwide that actually other environmental exposures put them at risk for this kind of lung injury. Worldwide, biomass fuel cooking is actually the biggest risk factor, although China continues to have its successes in recruiting smokers worldwide, it'll probably become tobacco smoke exposure. And basically what happens in COPD, the airways have a nonspecific response to this noxious gases that are coming in and down deep in the lungs in the small airways, it causes fibrosis and narrowing in the airways, which makes it harder for patients to get the air out. So every time they breathe out, they're not able to breathe all the air that went in all the way out. And slowly over time, the air sort of traps in their lungs, which makes them even more short of breath.
So that is basically what happens physically inside the body, but for the person who may be experiencing symptoms, what are the indications to that person that they may perhaps have COPD?
Well, the hard part is it's an insidious disease. You know, it's a tobacco or other exposures over decades. And over time, people, you know, as we get older, we get a little bit less active. Maybe we aren't challenging our heart and lungs as much as we did when we were 18. And slowly over time, people sort of start to view their shortness of breath on exercising as just a natural consequence of aging. They will continue to smoke as they become more and more sedentary, propagating a lung injury. And then finally, when they get to the point that they really have trouble even just getting around the house, they'll get evaluated and get formal breathing tests to find out whether or not that's the right diagnosis. And if so, then the physician will begin to treat it.
Do people tend to miss early warning signs for this?
Yeah, like I said, it happens in a middle age to older population, and people think this is just what happens when you get older. You know, they can't get across when they're shopping in the large box stores. They can't get all the way across, and they get kind of short-winded, and they'll attribute it to the fact that they're older, the fact that they maybe are a little bit out of shape and overweight. And, you know, until the disease gets pretty advanced, they don't necessarily come to the attention of a healthcare provider.
Right. Well, Courtney, let me ask you, since COPD is so closely associated with smoking, what is it about cigarettes and tobacco that is so darn addicting to begin with?
It's the nicotine that is found in those cigarettes. So within 7 to 10 seconds of the first puff of a cigarette, the nicotine receptors hijack the receptors in the brain to release dopamine. And that dopamine is released in the pleasure and reward center of the brain. It's called the nucleus accumbens. And that is where that pleasure safety signal is sent, where most drugs give that safety, warm feeling that they're drawn to and they get addicted to. And nicotine is the most addictive drug out there. It far beats cocaine, meth, any of them. It's nicotine. And that's why it is so hard to break the addiction and also the habit. So there's also a habit, you know, associated with it. But nicotine is the sole reason that they are addicted to those cigarettes.
And within the cigarette smoke, of course, there's much more than nicotine. What are the other chemicals that you're breathing in?
So when that cigarette is lit, there's over 7,000 chemicals being burned at once. So some of those are, we've got cyanide, acetone, formaldehyde. Right, I know. What else? Carbon monoxide, freon, lead. Naphthalene, which is found in mothballs. So
it's quite an assortment. Yeah. That if one had the opportunity to just I don't know, breathe those in as individual items, none of us would go near them. But no. Yet mm-hmm. It's part of that.
Not many people know that all of that is in there. And so that's just about 8 that I listed. So you can imagine what else is found in there. And also, as the years have gone by, it's what I explain to people is that the cigarettes that your parents smoked or the ones you grew up smoking, however old you are not the cigarettes that are on the market today. So not only did your price change, but the ingredients in these cigarettes have changed.
So you're a tobacco treatment specialist. I did have one specific question for you then. So you're approaching this. Were you or are you a cigarette smoker?
I was, yes. A closet smoker at that. And now everyone knows that I was a smoker because often they want to know why I have authority to give advice on someone, you know, to quit smoking. And I did. I smoked on and off for about 20 years. I do have that, but I'm also trained as a certified tobacco treatment specialist through the Mayo Clinic. And, so yes, but it is important because I understand what they're going through, but each individual, everyone is an individual and it's important to understand why they're smoking. And, that's very much part of the whole situation is finding out why they smoke. Because it's often part of how you're going to help them quit. It's their why. Because when it gets tough, it's what brings you back to why you're even trying and going through this process. It's your why.
Indeed. As you're listening this evening, you are welcome to give us a call if you have any questions related to the lungs or smoking. COPD specifically is one of the focal points on this program, and I imagine we'll also be touching a little bit on COVID. The number is 800-552-8502. Again, 800-552-8502. So please feel free to call and join in the conversation this evening on health matters. And again, my guest, Dr. Bob Walter, he's chief of pulmonary and critical care at LSU Health Shreveport. Courtney Rayburn is a tobacco treatment specialist with Willis-Knighton Health System. So, Dr. Walter, I'm going to turn back to you.
Can I follow up on
absolutely, that? Absolutely.
Knowing why you smoke is obviously really, really important, but knowing why you want to quit is also really important. I like to tell stories to my patients to help them kind of understand what I'm trying to explain to them. While I grew up in Shreveport, I did a lot of my training around the country, and I was in Boston for the better part of a decade. Mm-hmm. And I took care of people at the East Boston Neighborhood Health Center, which is a federally qualified neighborhood health center in East Boston, that part of Boston is basically the Ellis Island of Boston. If you know about how old somebody is that lives in East Boston, you can probably narrow down to 3 countries where they were born. And I was taking care of a lady who was originally born in Italy, and she came to the United States when she was in her early teens, and she was a 2-pack-a-day smoker. And at that point, the cigarettes were $5 a pack for a quarter cigarette. And we were talking about it, and I asked her, why do you want to stop? And she wanted to be there for her grandchildren. She wanted to see them graduate from high school and ultimately college, and maybe be able to see her great-grandchildren. So So, you know, sort of having established this was her goal, we decided to put in place a daily reward for not smoking. And we got her to get one of those big jugs that you see on water coolers, only empty. And for every cigarette she didn't smoke, she put a quarter into the jug. And initially that was really irritating because, you know, putting 25 cents or, you know, every single day, up to $10 worth of quarters were at play. And so finally she started not doing it in four cigarette increments so she could use dollar bills. And then ultimately said, this is just way too complicated. I'm putting the 10 bucks a day into the jar. 10 bucks a day, 365 days a year, $3,600 a year. 4 years later, she was able to take her two grandsons back to Italy and let them see where she grew up. And it was really giving her, it was her defining for herself the purpose of not smoking. Because clearly she smoked because she enjoyed it. So there had to be some greater reward to stopping this pleasurable thing. And your health, long-term health is an abstract. And this, by giving her dollars and this the possibility of doing something really great for her grandkids, she was actually able to be, you know, have that motivation finally to stop.
That's brilliant. So over that course of time, how well did her lungs recover? And in general, when you stop smoking, how much can the lungs recover?
So unfortunately, so COPD is not a curable disease except for by lung transplant, which I would argue isn't really a cure. It's trading one condition for another. Stopping smoking improves your life. There's only two treatments that improve life expectancy, smoking cessation, and for patients who have low oxygen levels, being on oxygen 24/7. And those are the only two things that actually improve life expectancy. Stopping smoking will slow down the rate of decline in your lung function. All of us lose collagen in our skin and elastin. We also, over time, lose collagen and elastin in our lungs. And so when a smoker stops smoking, they slow down to at or near the normal rate of decline as a consequence of age in terms of their lung function. So they're gonna extend the life of their lungs by stopping smoking, but they're not going to reverse that underlying lung loss that they've already had.
So the
it will also reduce their risk of lung cancer. By about 10 years, the risk of lung cancer in a former smoker who's 10 years abstinent is getting back close to the baseline risk. Beyond 10 years, they really are getting close to as though they never smoked. Although any damage to their airways, with any early COPD that they may have gotten, will still be there.
What are some of the warning signs that the disease has progressed to the point of lung cancer?
So lung cancer is a separate disease entirely. If you have COPD, you're especially at higher risk for lung cancer. It just shows that your lungs are relatively sensitive. Unfortunately, lung cancer is not typically found until people become really symptomatic and the disease is advanced and is beyond the curable stage. That said, we now know that people who are at risk beyond a certain age, who have a certain number of years of tobacco smoking, benefit from annual lung cancer screening by using low-dose CT. So people who have been smokers should discuss with their primary care doctors about the role of lung cancer screening, in addition to the colon cancer screening and breast cancer screening, et cetera, that we know benefit people. So you could be totally asymptomatic in terms of COPD and still be at risk for lung cancer.
Well, Courtney, let me turn back to you. Obviously, there's great incentive, or there should be, to quit smoking for people who are smoking. And Dr. Walter just mentioned one method that he used to encourage someone to stop. What are the treatment options for someone if someone wants to quit?
There's it's called NRT, which is nicotine replacement therapy. And that is most over-the-counter items like nicotine patches, nicotine lozenges or nicotine gum. They can all be bought over the counter along with Wellbutrin, is also, it is a pharmaceutical drug. It's not over the counter. That can be prescribed by your doctor. It is an antidepressant, but is also FDA approved for smoking cessation and counseling. There's also counseling, tobacco cessation counseling, that is very, I would say needed. For counseling is needed for smoking cessation. But I want to talk about a program that we have at Willis Knighton, if I could, that mm-hmm. would provide free nicotine patches, lozenges, and gum, and Wellbutrin, and counseling. So it's called the Smoking Cessation Trust. And this program is not a Willis Knighton program. It's a Louisiana resident program. And there's two qualifications. So you had to live in Louisiana, and then you had to have had a puff of a cigarette by 1988. Those are the only two requirements needed. So not born by 1988, but had a puff. So not full on smoking as a smoker by 1988, just a puff of a cigarette. And that gets you into the trust. And this trust, some people may have heard of it, but it stems from a class action lawsuit where Louisiana lawmakers sued the major tobacco companies. So this money all is in a trust from the major tobacco companies. And so we are able to provide free medication, and we do treatment plans on our patients to find out what method is best for them, what methods they've used in the past to quit smoking, and to provide them the right dosing for the patches. So it's anyone that meets those requirements. And they can go online to do it. They can call me to do it. It's available.
So if they're going online, where do they need to go if they're want to find out?
Yep, it's www.smokingcessationtrust.org. O-R-G.
Okay. You're listening to a conversation this evening on Health Matters, discussing COPD primarily, also smoking cessation. Dr. Bob Walter is Chief of Pulmonary and Critical Care at LSU Health Shreveport. Courtney Rayburn is a tobacco treatment specialist at Willis Knighton Health Systems. And of course, you can join the conversation. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. Dr. Walter, let me turn back to you. What tests do you use to diagnose COPD?
So COPD, as you pointed out, is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And there's a breathing test called spirometry, where patients basically take a deep breath in and blow as hard and as fast as they can out for at least 6 seconds. And it measures their airways function to see whether or not there's obstruction. And that really is the gold standard for diagnosing COPD.
When should someone see a physician? What point that should they hit and decide, I need to go see a doctor about this?
So anytime, as part of their health maintenance, you know, with the annual or biannual or twice a year, every other year exams that they're having, if they're actively smoking, they really should start the conversations with their primary care doctor. Hey, I'm thinking about stopping smoking. I'm thinking about moving away from this. And these are the things that I need help on in terms of really committing to it and following through. As part of the exams, the people used to look to see whether just screening spirometry was helpful. And it really wasn't, because it didn't really change your management. And so having the validating diagnosis before symptoms develop is probably not helpful, because you're just going to try to get the person to stop smoking. Again, the only things that are shown to improve life expectancy are stopping smoking, and oxygen therapy in advanced disease. Once people become symptomatic, there are some what we call bronchodilators, or medicines that make it a little bit easier to get the air out, that are there to reduce their symptoms. And so they're not curative. They're there to make people feel a little bit better. So really the time that you would pursue diagnosis is when people are starting to get short-winded to see how much the COPD may be playing a role. But again, prevention is an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, or a pound of mitigation, really.
Sure. If what about family members who don't necessarily smoke but live with a smoker? Does secondhand smoke play a role in getting COPD?
Yeah, about 80% of the people have significant personal histories of tobacco use. The other 20% are having other environmental issues. Sometimes it's persistent asthma. Sometimes it's environmental tobacco smoke exposure. We know kids born to smoking mothers have lower lung function in childhood. They don't reach as high a level of lung function in adulthood. And so there's effects on the members of the household that go beyond the person that is personally consuming tobacco.
So really that's another incentive for quitting, not just for yourself, but for the other people that you care about. What about other smoking options or inhaling options per se? Marijuana comes to mind. Where does that fit in?
So I'm old enough that I remember Bob Newhart's skits when he was a stand-up comedian. And he did one of those skits where he pretended to be Sir Walter Raleigh calling Queen Elizabeth about this wonderful idea with tobacco and how he was going to take some leaves and dry it up and grind it up and then light it on fire and breathe it in. Somehow inhaling into your lungs foreign burning substances just sounds like a bad idea. And whether that's, you know, marijuana or vaping or whatever else, our lungs are really delicate. They basically have to deal with the outside world, but at the same time stay so thin that a molecule of oxygen can get into our body and a molecule of carbon dioxide can come out. And so sort of throwing these other things into the mix to see whether or not it's going to set off problems just seems like a really bad idea.
Well, not everything, of course, is lit. Vaping, e-cigarettes have become very, very popular in this day and age.
None of them are you know, like pure substances. It's not like it's just water and nicotine. There's all sorts of other chemicals in there. And, you know, we saw this epidemic of short-term, really significant inflammatory responses, and that we call it Ebola. Where people would come in with just profoundly low oxygen levels and infiltrates. Their lungs were all inflamed, and then they ended up on the ventilator and the like. And so even if it's not actually on fire, there are a bunch of other chemicals in there that our body really doesn't like going down there. You know, ideally, the only thing that's making it down deep into the respiratory tract is the air that we're breathing, mostly nitrogen and oxygen, and we're getting rid of that carbon dioxide.
Courtney, let me just ask you, in relating to vaping, e-cigarettes, is there any other a different approach, or is it pretty much the same approach that you use when treating someone? I mean, I realize the nicotine addiction is the same, or perhaps increased. I've heard that there's actually more nicotine in the e-cigarettes.
Right. So I guess the approach is different because with cigarettes, they burn out. Right. So your cigarette lasts for, 3 to 4 minutes. E-cigarettes, vaping doesn't ever go out. They don't run out of juice. And so they're actually holding it and using it longer. And there's not a measure of time there. So we have to measure how many puffs they're taking. You know, when you have something that doesn't go out, they're using it a lot more than someone who is smoking something that's, you know, burning, that's going to burn out. So it's a little harder to measure. And then we have to find out we can measure their nicotine though, because that's measured where they buy it. We do not suggest replacing smoking with vaping as a safe alternative. We just do not do that. We don't know enough about it. There's no scientific evidence from the FDA or anything that supports any evidence that it's a safer method. And I find that it's basically a substitution for smoking. So people who smoke cigarettes that go to vaping, trying to quit smoking the cigarettes because of all of the tobacco in the cigarettes, most often return to the cigarette because vaping is not what they wanted in the first place. It's that cigarette. So they're trying to do something better for them. Some have gotten off the cigarettes with vaping, but you know, I steer my patients far from it because I can't support something I don't know anything about. And that's just kind of our stance on that. But we can gauge how much nicotine's in there and we can, you know, titrate down from that. And we can still use the patches and lozenges and gum like that to help with cravings. But you're dealing with an item that doesn't burn out like a cigarette does. So it is a little bit more challenging when it's so accessible.
I could see that. You're listening tonight to Health Matters, and Dr. Bob Walter, who's Chief of Pulmonology and Critical Care at LSU Health Shreveport, is joining me along with Courtney Rayburn, who is a tobacco treatment specialist with Willis-Knighton Health System. And again, I want to give you the phone call. You're welcome to join this conversation at 800-552-8502. Again, 800-552-8502. And Dr. Walter, I'm going to turn back to you. What about genetics with COPD? If you've had someone in your family who has COPD, or at some point someone in your family, does that affect your likelihood of coming down with it?
So there are certain diseases that are what we call major gene disorders that a quarter or half of the kids of the affected person will actually get the disease. There is a version of emphysema, severe alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency that is passed on in that sort of fashion. That's a relatively rare version of the disease and is... You know, if you had a family member that had that genetics, you would probably want to get tested. Although, again, your smoking is, I can't think of a time that smoking is a good idea. And so you would want to avoid, whether you have that gene or not, you're going to want to avoid cigarettes. That said, there are other genetic components to the sensitivity to tobacco, and it's clearly heritable, and there is a significant genetic component to it, though it's not like, you know, cystic fibrosis, where there's a high level of determinism. It really is a gene by environmental interaction. You have the susceptibility, and then you either are out there smoking, you're working in grain warehouses, other things, you know, having these other environmental exposures, and those two things come together to cause you to actually get the disease.
You were mentioning working in warehouses, that type of thing. So aside from cigarette smoke, what are other irritants, causes, things that can relate to getting COPD?
We don't see it as much because of the the occupational work safety rules that are there. But really anywhere that you feel like you would need a respirator, again, our lungs are pretty smart. If you walk into an environment where there's tons of stuff in the air, you're going to start coughing. And if you feel like you need a respirator, that's probably not the best place because a lot of the particulate stuff and the chemicals are getting down into your lungs. And your lungs are not going to like that. There's going to be a bunch of inflammation, and it can cause that same fibrotic reaction down in the small airways. There are a bunch of different occupations that are not so common anymore. People who did like wool sorters and grain elevator workers, miners, just the kind of places that you'd expect that a respirator would probably be handy have all been associated with COPD and or other lung disease.
What about just irritants that are around the house that one might not think about?
they indirectly can contribute to it, because people who have poorly controlled asthma, that asthma, when I'm talking to the medical students, I make the distinction, and it's made more generally, COPD is mostly irreversible airflow obstruction, and asthma is mostly reversible airflow obstruction. One is a very, with COPD, you have a non-specific inflammation going on. It's just, you've got these general irritants coming down, and you get a non-specific cellular response to that. In contrast, asthma, you're allergic to something, and it goes down, and a particular kind of antibody grabs it and sets off a very particular chain reaction through very particular cells, which causes your airways to get twitchy and have mucus hypersecretion and the like. If you have persistent asthma where it's you're really not controlling it, you ultimately can just start laying down fibrosis in the small airways, and you get a COPD-like condition.
Okay. I have another question for you, Courtney. One thing that Dr. Walter mentioned earlier is that by stopping smoking, you cannot go back and cure the disease once you have it. But of course, there are many other symptoms that are part of smoking that one can have. What in your particular case, you work with people to get them to stop smoking. What are some of the benefits that you have seen, not necessarily related to COPD, but just in general people's lives?
Oh gosh. Their sense of smell and taste is improved just by cutting down, 7 to 10 cigarettes a day. Their sense of smell and taste come back. Their cigarette starts to, their taste of the cigarette starts to change. If they smoke in their home, they are now able to smell what their home actually smells like, or their car. If they smoke in their car, they can, if they're in the hospital, if I meet them inpatient and let's say the husband and wife both smoke and the wife is in the hospital, then when that husband comes in, she can smell his clothes that smell like, their home. So all those senses come back. Their energy level is increased dramatically. They can walk from one end of the room to the other, or go shopping in those larger stores without having as much trouble. The body just rewards itself so quickly once they start to cut down on that smoking, which then their confidence, their self-esteem and confidence is also increased. And once that gets going, then they're able to, they tend to keep cutting down on their smoking. And with guidance and counseling, that's, encouraged and accounted for. And so it's all the kind of things that are on the outside of the body, but even all the other good, great things are going on the inside, but they feel great about themselves. And sometimes people who smoke aren't happy that they're smokers. Maybe they've tried over and over to quit and haven't been successful, but now they're starting to see some success, just having that support, and they feel good and it shows and they're happy, so they keep going.
Smoking seems to take up such a big part of people's lives when they're smokers. Mm-hmm. What age do people generally start smoking? And I know this is also a big concern with teens, because I remember the temptation and all that as a kid myself, but mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's changed over the years. I remember what it was like then, but what about now?
Well, the last report they ran, it was around 15 years old is when they start. So, and then, and then 99, they said 15 years old, but 99% of the people have tried smoking by 18 years old. So there's that. So by 18, most people have tried a cigarette. Yes.
So when you encounter a patient that is trying to quit, how many years have they likely have been smoking at that point? Are your patients generally older, some younger, in between?
I would say most of my patients have been smoking about 40 years.
So a lifetime. Literally a lifetime.
40 years, yeah. And the young ones, I love getting hold of those young ones, I do.
Preventing future COPD.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just, yeah, because the trust, but I wanted to say one thing, that with the smoking cessation trust, it doesn't cover those young adolescents, where I wish it did, you know, so that we could help those not start smoking. So I love to educate the ones that need that help, or the parents that are wondering what to do. I've done that as well. But also, insurance companies are now, a lot of them have smoking cessation policies. And so there is coverage. And so I encourage everyone to look at their insurance coverage and see what there is for those adolescents. And then, you know, they could still call their physician or me, and I can help them get started in a program. So it's not just the trust, but most likely in their insurance that we're finding out can also cover cessation products, like I talked about, the patches and the lozenges. And these kids that, these boys that are dipping, you know, where it's real popular to have that skull mark on their jeans. And so that's kind of a thing. So that should be addressed early on as well. It's all about education.
My guest this evening, Courtney Rayburn, who's a tobacco treatment specialist with Willis Knight and Health Systems, Dr. Bob Walter, chief of pulmonology and critical care at LSU Health Shreveport. And you are welcome to give us a call. Call tonight, 800-552-8502. If you have a question or maybe want to reflect on your own personal experience, this would be a welcome call. So again, the number is 800-552-8502. And Dr. Walter, when this is kind of from personal observation, when I think of someone having emphysema or COPD, this has been where I have seen it in relatives in my family. The usual one thing that's characteristic is they have an oxygen tank or something with them. At what stage does the disease get to when oxygen therapy becomes a treatment?
So oxygen, there are several larger studies that looked at a particular population. And those people, their oxygen levels were significantly low. Yours, hopefully, is around 100%. And they were looking at them 88% and below. And as a result, Medicare will only pay for people when they've gotten to a point that their oxygen levels are far enough below normal that they would, they might have been part of that trial. That said, you know, that's about payers. We know that people even that haven't reached that part, that have significant obstruction, who do have significant disease that are not real good, they don't have good exercise tolerance. If you put them on oxygen and exercise them, their exercise capacity gets better. And so we know at a certain point it improves life expectancy, but we also know earlier in this that actually it can help with their exercise performance. So we actually, for people who are kind of on the edge, we do everything we can to make sure that we can qualify them under their payers' rules to get put on oxygen when they get to that point. That said, I wouldn't say if someone's got totally normal lung function as a smoker, going over to oxygen was a good idea. But once they have truly symptomatic disease, especially associated with lower oxygen levels, you know, lower levels of lung function, that they should, we try to do what we can to get them on to oxygen, because it'll help them feel better and it'll help them live longer.
So referenced exercise, is that basically what we would consider to be pulmonary rehab? And can you talk a little bit more about its effectiveness?
Sure. Pulmonary rehab exercise is always good. If you have heart and lung disease, or lung disease or heart disease, freestanding, the more efficient your body is, the better it'll do, even if you have bad lungs or bad heart. So there's cardiac rehab and there's pulmonary rehab, and there's all sorts of physical rehabs. And it's just because even if the engine ain't that great, if you tune it up, it's going to do a whole lot better. Pulmonary rehab is specifically designed for people with significant lung disease, most often that's COPD, And it gives them exercises that are really tailored towards improving their endurance. And they do it in an environment where they're around other people who are suffering the same diseases. And it includes, especially for the COPDers, a smoking cessation component. And it shows improved quality of life, lower risk of ending up in the hospital, et cetera. But exercise is, fortunately or unfortunately, a lifetime commitment. And so the pulmonary rehab teaches you what you should do and really sort of hopefully gets you in a habit. But then you have to take those lessons home with you and continue in that wellness program, avoiding cigarettes, keeping up the same sorts of exercises, which can be as simple as walking. The effects of pulmonary rehab tend to sort of slide when people aren't being watched. They tend to regress to their normal, you know, the old habits and old behaviors. And so Medicare and other payers typically will do, will pay for a renewal program where they come back periodically. And there are efforts looking at, can you do something like telemedicine support where at different intervals after they've kind of graduated from the initial thing where you're checking back in on them and making sure that they're continuing that program at home.
All right. Well, we have our first caller of the evening. This is Sydney from Alexandria. Sydney, go ahead with your question this evening.
I was going to ask, how do you feel about vaping instead of smoking? I know there's been a lot of bad stigmata all through the media about vaping, but I personally have a story that I'd like to share with you. I started smoking at 9 years old. My father passed away, and I smoked all through my Army career, all the way up until early last year. And I was going to see the pulmonologist at the VA when he enlightened me to the fact that he said that if I was one pack away from being full-blown emphysema. And a buddy of mine had convinced me to try vaping. Well, I tried it, and I liked it. But the vaping, I like, when I picked it up, I completely put down the cigarette and focused on vaping. Well, a couple of months later, I went back, and they did a chest x-ray on me to check and see had I gotten worse or what's going on. It was basically a follow-up to me. And the doctor told me, he said, man, I don't know what you're doing, but continue to do it because you now have the lungs of a 20-year-old. I'm 34, and I've been smoking three and a half packs a day from the time I was about 15 years old.
All right. Got a comment on that?
So, you know, sometimes life gives us bad options and worse options. I think most people would agree that vaping is not healthy, straight up healthy. But if you're choosing between inhaling the smoke of burning leaves with more than 70 known carcinogens, plus all sorts of other chemicals that we talked about earlier, versus something that has less of that, maybe that's the lesser of two evils, but there's not a lot of quality control in the vaping products. You can go to a lot of the tobacco stores and they mix it up themselves and heaven only knows what's actually in there. There were concerns about some of the flavorings that people put in, and you're adding a lot of variables in there that just are unknown. And so is it likely that vaping is less injurious than smoking tobacco? It's likely that's the case, but it's not like it's a healthy option. It's not like saying, okay, I'm going to eat celery instead of smoking. It's clearly vaping is going to be worse than a healthier lifestyle. So, you know, it's not ideal, but it may be that it is less toxic. And if one were going to do vaping, irrespective of that, advice and understanding, I would tend to think that on average, the vaping products that are manufactured and put into true electronic cigarettes, the quality control there is going to, one would expect that it would be higher than going to a vaping store where someone whips up some mix for you with, you know, again, heaven only knows what's in it. So it's not an ideal thing, but I know that I have patients that have said, you know, this is what I have to do to stop smoking. And I emphasize that it is not the healthy option. It is maybe the less toxic of the two, but not ideal.
Yeah, go ahead, Courtney.
Sydney, maybe just use the vape to get off the cigarettes, but try not to use it long enough to get addicted to the vape. You see what I'm saying? And then, so just use the vape long enough to, you know, curb those cravings to actually smoke a cigarette. And then you could always move to a nicotine patch based on how much nicotine's in that juice that you're getting.
Yeah.
But you could easily get addicted to the vape. Like you know, like Dr. Walter was saying, with the lesser known, it's not a healthy choice. Just what he was saying, it's not the healthier choice, but just don't get addicted to the vape. That's what I would suggest. I would not use it any longer than you had to. Just get off the cigarettes, then get off the vape, and then and use it less and less each day, and monitor yourself. Hold yourself accountable for the puffs on the vape. Only allow yourself certain amount of puffs each day. And the nicotine lozenges are very effective, and they're over the counter. Very effective. So I would check into getting a 2 milligram lozenge. Extremely effective, sugar-free. They last anywhere from 30 minutes to an hour and a half. You park it in your lip, like just down by your gum line. And that would be a very strong choice as well. But that would be my suggestion, is don't get addicted to that vape.
All right, Sydney, thank you very much for your question. Good question indeed. And as you're listening, give us a call at 800-552-8502, and you can ask your question tonight on Health Matters. My guests, Dr. Bob Walter, who's chief of pulmonology and critical care at LSU Health Shreveport, and Courtney Rayburn, who is a tobacco treatment specialist with the Willis-Knighton Health System. So another question, and obviously there are all types of people that smoke, or for that matter vape, or do e-cigarettes. Are there certain groups of people in terms of their demographic or socioeconomic status, men, women, who are more at risk than others for getting COPD?
So, I mean, a lot of it tracks the smoking habits of the group that you're coming from. The tobacco companies lately have been targeting African Americans, and we're seeing a rise in the frequency or the prevalence of COPD among the African American community. There's some evidence that women are more susceptible to the effects of smoking, and it may be that you're inhaling the same amount, or you're inhaling the same concentration of toxins, but you're putting it over a smaller surface area. So effectively the concentration in the airways is higher just because women are smaller. That said, there's also some evidence that estrogen may actually impact your risk. And so women may be at higher risk. But as we were talking about, again, when the main risk factor is so well known, just stopping smoking will make it so you don't, you have a very, very, very low risk of COPD.
All right, we have our next question. This is Fred from Shreveport. Fred, go ahead with your question.
Hi there, and thanks for this conversation. I've been smoking for about 4 or 5 years, and I recently quit a couple of months ago using this book, The Easy Way to Stop Smoking by Alan Carr. And what he does is he talks a lot about the psychological, you know, baggage that smoking has, and how he sort of erases that over the book. And I was wondering if you guys could comment on, you know, how we feel as smokers. Like, it seems like such a mountain to climb to quit smoking. And once you do try to stop smoking, it feels like you're being deprived of, you know, this thing that you used to like. I know you mentioned that one of your clients smoked because she thought it was pleasurable. But it's really, it seems like a trick we're playing on ourselves to continue to do it and feed the addiction. Can you talk about the psychological, you know, aspects of the addiction and how much that plays into it?
Sometimes, often, we view our cigarettes as a best friend, right? Because they're there for us through thick and thin, whether we're sad, happy, traumatized, they're there for every emotion. And so when we're trying to break that habit, it can be very hard to detach from the cigarette. And oftentimes, you know, I've heard suggestions where writing a letter to your best friend, as in the cigarette, often helps because you're able just to get that on paper, those emotions of connection that you have with that cigarette. And just basically telling it that, you know, you're no good for me and we're breaking up and this is why you're killing me, you know, and just putting that on paper, putting it in an envelope, and it actually has done a lot of people some good. And you had said something just when you first started talking, and I kind of lost it in my mind, but kind of lost my train of thought right there. I finally remembered. What I think is most important when someone is trying to stop smoking, that's what we kind of think of, like, oh, you need to quit smoking. Like every doctor out there says, you need to quit smoking. But really, no one wants to hear that. When you say that or when doctors say that, they're like, oh, another doctor telling me I've got to quit smoking. But really, what I tell people is you need to cut down on your smoking. And those words, cut down on smoking, come across so much better than the shock of you need to quit, you have to stop, you know? So I think if we changed our terminology a little bit, it just eases them into it. And then I back it up with how we're going to quit, you know, like with cutting down. So we're going to cut down on our smoking, even though the end result is quitting, it's just a softer blow. But you don't go through the cravings, you know, you use the patches and you're able to actually smoke with those patches. And so it's an easier thing. So people, I don't know, you just figure out, you know, what they have gone through before, but cutting down is often better than just cold turkey. Or a lot of people don't understand that you can just cut down with patches and you don't have to just like throw them in the trash and try to like what I call white knuckle it and get through the day without, you know, a cigarette. So, but it is a very emotional and a lot of people go through frustration. That's why that Wellbutrin can be very helpful because that can lessen the anxiety of the whole thing. So,
I'm talking to patients that are trying to quit. You know, we talk about the idea that every cigarette you're not smoking was a good cigarette. Two packs a day is bad, but it's better than four packs a day. And one pack a day is better than two packs a day. And with that patient I talked about before, she saw that in dollars. You know, yes, she smoked. There was a time she was smoking a pack a day, but she was still putting $5 a day into the big bucket. So she saw that there was a positive side to that. And honestly, you know, the other thing is you do something for 30 years, 20 times a day, and it's going to be with you for a long time. I have a patient, an acquaintance that I've talked to that now, having quit more than 40 years ago, still periodically pats his pocket on a shirt looking for the pack of cigarettes. Right. So, I mean, it's a hard thing to break. There's no doubt about it. And it's a lifestyle change for the rest of your life.
Right.
Well, Fred, I want to thank you for making your call and your question tonight. We are getting close to the end of the show, so we probably cannot fit in one more call. Although if it's a quick one, give us a call at 800-552-8502. I wanted to ask you guys just since we are in the time of the coronavirus. How has COVID-19 been affecting patients with COPD, and are there extra precautions that should be taken?
So, people with COPD are at higher risk for worst cases of coronavirus. So that if you're COPD, if you have COPD, you're a smoker, and you get coronavirus, you're more likely to have severe disease than if you didn't have the COPD and or you were not a smoker. And so it certainly has impacted them. The other thing that has really impacted them is, a lot of the people have lung disease, and their ability to get around was already fairly limited. And the coronavirus has had a big impact on them in terms of social isolation. And I really like the explosion of telemedicine and technology that has gotten out there to try to connect these people who have legitimate concerns about their health. And it connects them to the health system. It connects them to their friends and family.
Mm-hmm. We have one more, hopefully a quick question from Bill from Shreveport. Do you want to go ahead? We have just a couple minutes left.
Yes, sir. I quit smoking in 99. I smoked for about 20 years. I was probably about back a day smoker. And I quit, and because I wanted to try to regain my health back, because I just got winded when I tried to run and stuff, and I was trying to exercise. And I was wondering, about how long does this take for your body to heal back up after you quit smoking, to get your wind back, to get back to where you once were or should be?
So the symptoms like a chronic productive cough tend to get better over the course of a year. Unfortunately, the stopping smoking doesn't reverse the damage that was already done if you have COPD, but it does make it so that the rate at which you lose lung function is that you would expect as a normal consequence of aging. So it never goes away. If you're still having symptoms, being seen by your doctor, finding out how, validating the diagnosis of COPD would be important. And then there are things that can give people a little bit more pep in their step. The inhalers make people feel better. In the cases of advanced COPD, advanced emphysema, there are some new novel treatments that are out there that help people breathe easier. But those are really for people with very, very advanced disease.
All right. And we are sadly at the end of the show here. We're out of time. Dr. Bob Walter, Chief of Pulmonology and Critical Care at LSU Health Shreveport, Courtney Rayburn, who is Tobacco Treatment Specialist at Willis-Knighton Health System. First of all, thank you both so very much for being a part of the show tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or health professional. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. The views expressed on Health Matters may not necessarily express those of Red River Radio, LSUS, or staff. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Phone assistance has been provided this evening by Wally Derleth. Production of Health Matters is made possible in part by the Noel Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Please join us next Thursday for Health Matters. I'm Kermit Poling. I had the pleasure of hosting this evening. Thank you for joining us.